Hey, everybody. Welcome to Latter-day Struggles. This is your host, Valerie. I am excited to be here with you today. I'm a little nervous because there is just so much to say. I wonder if you're surprised that today I am going to be talking about and doing some responding to the flurry of the last week or so. I guess it started last Sunday. So for those of you who are listening to this, you know, weeks or months later, this won't be in context with you. But for those of you who are listening to this live, or as close to live as one can be on a podcast, you know, and I know this has been a very, very interesting week in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints circles. To give a little tiny bit of a brief overview, on Sunday, there was a general women's conference. I believe it was to commemorate or celebrate the Relief Society birthday or something of that nature. And then following that, connected to that, I suppose, was a post on the church's official website that indicated that women of our church had more power and authority than women of other churches. Let me go ahead and just read that to you to give some of you some context. I dare say you probably are familiar with this, but just in case somebody out there is not, here we go. The post itself says, "There is no other religious organization in the world that I know of that has so broadly given power and authority to women." This is a quote by Sister J. Annette Dennis, who I believe is in the Relief Society General Presidency. And then her caption says this: "There is no other religious organization in the world that I know of that has so broadly given power and authority to women. There are religions that ordain some women to positions such as priests and pastors, but very few, relative to the number of women in their congregations, receive that authority that their church gives them. By contrast, all women 18 years and older in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints who choose a covenant relationship with God in the house of the Lord are endowed with priesthood power directly from God. And as we serve in whatever calling or assignment, including ministering assignments, we are given priesthood authority to carry out these responsibilities. My dear sisters, you belong to a church which offers all its women priesthood power and authority from God." Close quote. As of today, I'm recording this on Friday, March 22nd, 2024. This particular post has garnered likes by 65,997 people, and the comments are in the multiple thousands. This clearly really activated and woke up a lot of women in and around the Church of Jesus Christ, inclusive of some men as well. So this is wonderful in some ways. I'm not saying that the quote itself is wonderful, of course, but I am saying that what it did for me personally was awaken the reality that there are many of us out here who are having a similar spiritual awakening or feminist awakening. And I mean that in every way positive. I know that as we read through these comments, it seems as if feminists, the word feminist or feminism in some ways is experienced or meant to be very, very negative or derogatory. I do not take it that way. And so I wanted to spend today talking to you about a flood of thoughts that came over me. I asked at the beginning of this podcast if you were surprised that I was here so soon. If you are, then you can join me in your surprise. I had no intention of recording this as quickly as I have, and I wasn't going to, because I really wanted to wait and simmer on this. And I would have done that because I have no problem with that. But 2 days ago, just about 48 hours ago, I was getting up in the morning and doing my normal routine. And as is sometimes the case with me, what happened is I began to do my routine, inclusive of exercise and kind of just a place where I move into sort of a little bit more of a contemplative mode. And thoughts started just flooding my mind and ideas. And whenever that happens, I usually pause and grab my phone and start taking notes. And one idea led to another, which led to another, which led to another. And next thing you know, I thought, oh my goodness, I have a lot to say about this. And for that reason, while something is fresh on my mind, that's usually the best time to externalize it and to talk to you about it. And so I sort of cleared my schedule, tweaked some things in my life, and decided to come to you today so that I can offer to you my thoughts. Now, what you're going to be hearing today is not sort of a cohesive narrative or dialogue that, so in other words, each point doesn't necessarily connect to each other point, but every point is basically what I'm experiencing or making sense of. One of my favorite things to do as a psychotherapist is I have always loved working with graduate level students and young therapists early in their professional development. And I love case conceptualization. What that means is somebody will explain to me a phenomenon that's going on in the counseling room, and we will talk about what is happening, like big picture. Like we'll hover around the topic and talk about phenomenon that is likely informing this case. And so as I was witnessing this whole thing unfold right before my very eyes, not only was I experiencing it firsthand as a female here in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but I also had I was grateful that I have my training and the skill set to sort of take a step back and observe and just watch things as they were unfolding and try to better understand the phenomenon that's going on and the psychology that was making this experience as it unfolded incredibly, incredibly fascinating and interesting. I myself saw the post on Sunday evening, probably 30 to 60 minutes after it was posted. A few of you in this audience actually sent it to me, and I took a look at it, you know, with the typical response. But then I clicked on the comments, fully expecting the comments to be typical of what one often sees on the church's official Instagram website. And it wasn't. It wasn't. It was actually women who were responding from a place of a lot of emotion and a lot of pain. And immediately, of course, my interest became amplified. And I was like, whoa, what is going on here? This is fascinating. And one of the first things I thought of is, isn't this interesting that the LDS Church has a founding ideology around checks and balances? The founding leader of this church, Joseph Smith, actually talked about something he called the law of common consent. This is probably not news to any of you listening to this. This idea that we put before the audience or the constituency matters of importance, doctrine, theology, administration, and the constituency themselves actually needs to vote in or decide. They have a voice in important matters that pertain to the institution itself. That used to be the case. There's even evidence, stories in the history about how this actually happened and how it was effective. It, of course, went away. At least we have it in name only at this point in time. Now it's more just a rubber stamp, and there's actually consequences to somebody in a formal church setting if you raise your hand and sort of dissent. That doesn't generally mean they're going to listen. It actually just means that they're going to be very cautious about you and your dissenting ways. So what I started thinking about quite early on in this process was we are witnessing a modern day iteration of the law of common consent here in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through the internet. And of course, that is the great democratizer of data and information. And so why wouldn't it be there? Of course it would be there. That makes so much sense to me. So basically, when this post came out, in essence, I'm being metaphorical here, but just bear with me. In essence, the question was asked, all in favor, and that's where we'd have commented, or those who have commented did comment, and then all opposed. And in the thousands and thousands, our own women raised their hand or raised their voice in dissent. They said, no, we don't have equality in this church. We don't have power and authority likened to the women of other religious institutions. No. And a common thread that ran throughout many of the comments, at least early on, was, please stop saying this because it isn't true. And it's actually kind of insulting. And so here we are, and I am actually incredibly, incredibly grateful. I don't know what the, I'm not in the room where it happens, but I'm grateful that this conversation was allowed to be had on the church's formal website. It is so important to realize that we might be witnessing a pretty important moment in the history of our young church institution, because for a long time, there hasn't been a forum where women can have their voice. And it's pretty lovely, in my opinion, that it is on the actual official page of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints on their Instagram account that this was able to happen. And the thing that I find is very important and pertinent to this conversation is that in some way, the women who commented because they're somewhat engaged. They have some identity connected to the LDS Church. They are members or they are post members or they care. That's why they were there. Now, I'm not saying that all of them are followers of this particular account. That is irrelevant, but they voiced up because this matters to them. And as I was watching this whole thing unfold, it occurred to me that it would be so important for the church to regard all of this dialogue as something very, very important, because it's not always about what it's about. It's, of course, about power and equality. That is the text. But the subtext is there are many thousands of women who care enough to contribute to this conversation. In one or one and a half generations, maybe even less than one generation, I dare say this would be a smaller conversation, not because the problem has been solved, but because the women and their children have left. And they are no longer interested in the dialogue because they have, in fact, perhaps disengaged so much from this institution that they are no longer interested enough in bringing their voices to this conversation. So to me, this is a huge cautionary tale that, like, please listen to the voices of these women and the men. I want to make sure I make clear that I appreciate and honor good, wonderful feminist men. There are many of them in my growth and processing groups. Every single one of my groups is both gendered, men and women. And there are some incredibly passionate male feminists. And so if you're one of those that doesn't believe a male can be a feminist, I'm going to have to respectfully disagree with you, because I've seen many of them and I actually live with one. My own husband is one, as you all know. Nathan's a wonderful feminist. So, okay, what I want to do now is I want to just transition over to offering to you some of these points, some of these thoughts that I had regarding what is unfolding here in this wave of interest around issues of gender equality here in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. First of all, I want to make sure that I give voice, at least for the beginning, for a moment, to the reality that there are people in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, both women and men, who are not having this experience. They are genuinely satisfied in the church. They don't see a problem. They wonder what's going on, and they really are struggling with those of us who are having a different experience. I think this is one of those moments for me where I guess there is a little part of me that is grateful that I was such a late bloomer. I was not a precocious feminist at all. It's actually quite a new part of my identity development. Just in the last many years, I have awakened and noticed, wow, there's a lot here that I did not see. I did not see for so many years the struggles and the problems with gender equality here in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And for that reason, I do want to offer an invitation that we all have some compassion on people that don't see things the same as we do, and that their experience is legitimate and it is theirs. And I often have to work myself through this, but I frequently am working with my own beloved small group members about this. We can't force people into a level of development where they are not. We couldn't be forced into a different level of development, and nor can they. It's kind of part of what we all like to talk about when we talk about agency. Sometimes we feel really strongly about certain things when it benefits us, but we feel a little bit less committed to it when it doesn't benefit us, right? And so this is one of those moments where I think it's important to go, wow, this is a big subject, but everybody does not feel this way. I think there are some out there who are more traditionally believing who truly don't see it. I do think there are some who do see it, but they see themselves in quite a bit of a double bind. What that means is they're kind of damned if they do and damned if they don't. If they step into this conversation, if they really let themselves go down the track of acknowledging issues of gender equality in the LDS Church, there is a fear sometimes that what does this mean? What does this mean about my belief system? What does this mean about my identity? What does this mean about how do I parent? How do I worship? How do I experience myself as a spiritual person? How do I relate with my family? And for some people, the terror of stepping into deeper truth and spiritual growth is so paralyzing that they opt out. And there may be some of you out there who remembers yourself having spent some portion of your life in the opt-out place. And then sometimes either we become resourced enough or we have enough experiences that pressure us to go ahead and just grow. And sometimes growth becomes inevitable because experiences of our life sort of mandate us. And so I just want us to kind of keep in mind that this double bind for some people is really important. And it's really important to consider so that we can have compassion on everyone. It's also super important for us, I think, to recognize that for many of us, our Latter-day Saint identity is really, really pervasive. It's part of who we are, which makes a crisis of faith incredibly painful. It makes us feel like, well, if I go down this path, I don't know where I find myself at the end. It might be more comfortable to stay here, even though I'm uncomfortable, because the discomfort of the unknown and sort of forging a whole new sense of reality, different than what has been taught us through the more structured, correlated story of the LDS Church, is for some incredibly unknown and scary. And I think for many of us too, we don't realize that there is something beautiful at the end of this, right? Or is there even an end? Probably not. But that we don't necessarily have the eyes to see because we haven't been there yet. We don't realize that by going on a faith journey and by actually addressing tough issues like gender equality, that there's something at the end which is deeply and profoundly more spiritual as opposed to less spiritual. I think a lot of us feel or are worried that that is not the case. And so we dig in our heels, which brings me to my first point. So what I'm about ready to kind of discuss here is I'm going to be offering to you, let's just talk about some of the reasons why our church seems to be having perpetual and chronic problems addressing this issue of gender and looking at the question of women and authority. One of the topics that really came to my mind is the concept of cognitive dissonance and self-deception. I did an episode a little while ago. It's episode 109 of the Latter-day Struggles podcast, and it is called The Slippery Slope of Self-Justification. And in that episode, I walk everyone through the following ideas: why humans and institutions self-justify, why people in leadership are specifically prone to self-justification, why entire communities get caught up in self-justifying behaviors. And I also discuss the self-justifying tactics that people and institutions use when they are called out for questionable behaviors. And I also talk about what can be done to overcome one's tendency to self-justify. Okay, so I want to just lead you back to that episode because it doesn't make any sense for me to just re-record the same content. So if you want to go really deeply into this, jump over to episode number 109 of Latter-day Struggles. If I do say so myself, it's really great, deep, rich content. How it pertains to this topic, though, for me, from where I sit, is it seems to me that sometimes early on in the development of an idea, we might look upon the idea in a semi sort of neutral way. And I'm supposing most of you have had an experience like this, which is kind of you're exposed to something and you're like, how do I feel about this? I don't know. And you kind of assess and see what everyone else thinks and kind of just, you know, do the regular things that one does when they're trying to interpret reality and truth, right? And so at that point in one's discerning process, they don't feel strongly one way or the other. But when one starts to solidify their ideas, they move into a stance where they can not remember when they felt differently. And then when one engages in behaviors connected to the commitment to that idea, they actually double and triple down. They move from an openness very, very early on in the process to a closedness to where they can't even imagine ever having had any openness. And then they engage in behaviors that prove to themselves that this is right. And that's basically self-justification theory. I don't know if this is what's going on here, but there is a piece of me that wonders if there is something at an unconscious level that is going on in the more traditionally believing mind of the Latter-day Saint and in the church leadership, which is we have committed to this idea of male priesthood power. And even though there may be some small part of them that is hard to acknowledge that it is strange in 2024 that women don't have equality, rather than confronting that, it's shoved down and the behaviors and the practices and procedures are actually strengthened rather than weakened to help them feel more justified in the doctrine. Okay, my next point that I want to address that I have been thinking about when it comes to why are we having these issues here in the LDS Church is I am concerned that what we are experiencing right now is the outcome of a history and a great deal of commitment to a lack of broad liberal arts education, including theological education, understanding and more scholarship around early Christianity, comparative religion, divinity, American history, world history, feminist theory, gender studies, queer theory, philosophy, psychology, mental health. It to me seems like when a religious system commits itself to being the one true church, its level of inquiry plummets because when you have direct access to God, it's kind of like a loophole out of all of the other ways that the rest of humanity finds light and truth. If you can go straight to God, you don't have to learn about philosophy and psychology. You don't have to learn about feminist theory or queer theory. You can actually just go straight to God. And so in some ways, I feel like it is an unconscious loophole that has and is continuing to catch up with us. Because the more we see scholarship blossoming in all of these areas, and the less willing and able we are to look at it from the place of beginner's mind, as a place of a learner, from a place of curiosity, the more we lose touch with truth. I believe, and I'll probably say this a few times, if we want to use the word restoration, our church likes to use that word, right? If we want to think about the concept of restoration, it is my belief that our higher powers are actually constantly restoring truth and light throughout the world, throughout the traditions, throughout academia, throughout the secular world, throughout the spiritual world, because quite frankly, everything is spiritual, right? And so if we aren't willing to be open to how revelation comes and the means through which it comes as broadly as I believe it comes, then we are going to be paralyzing ourselves in very, very powerful and dangerous ways, especially because in this age of the internet and in this age where we are advancing, of course we're advancing, we're always advancing. And so if we don't want to participate in that because of our status as the one true church, because we feel a sense of superiority from the rest of the world, and also because we have a sense or there's part of our ideology that positions us against them, and also treats, you know, I think about the idea of the world kind of in hand quotes. We are not the world. We will not participate in the world. What that means is all of the gifts of knowledge and light and truth that comes from that very world, we have cut ourselves off from, which brings us to this place in this moment in time right now, where, as we have all been witness to, the shackles of patriarchy, they're falling in many places, especially here in the Western world. And because we tend to resist participation in this version of the restoration, we are cutting ourselves off from the restoration itself. I want to just stay with this topic for just a minute. And as I do so, I want to preface what I'm about ready to say by offering to you some qualifications here. I personally am not a genders theory scholar. I am not a queer theorist. I am not a theologian. I'm not a lot of things, but I do dabble in a few things, probably enough perhaps just to be dangerous, but also enough to at least acknowledge that there is a really important intersection going on in the church between these issues of feminist issues, gender issues, and issues of sexuality. It's no surprise that we struggle with all of them. Now, what do I mean by this? It is my belief that one of the things that is typical of all of the human race and of culture in general is what we notice is this sort of ongoing wrestle with existential anxiety. And this existential anxiety brings up the desire for people to have power over other people. and to create in-groups and out-groups. I have an entire podcast series on this, and it begins with episode number 143 of Latter-day Struggles, and it's called The Psychology of the Creation of Power Hierarchies and Those They Dominate. And so it's a four-part series where I really break down the creation of this concept of the other, or as Gerda Lerner calls it, the deviant other. And so jump into that series if you're interested in this concept of how humanity has always struggled with power. And they basically just take the differences of someone in order to dominate over them. And so what we're seeing here in our church tradition is very typical of what happens in any large organization and any structure where there are struggles with power, which is basically all structures tend to struggle with power. Some do so in, well, they look differently and they behave differently, but this is part of the human condition. We here in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints have, from our very beginning, struggled with issues of gender, sexuality, and power. All you have to do is look at the concept of polygamy and see that we have our own sort of idiosyncratic rendering of this very problem. Now, let's go deeper into that. And as I mentioned before, I'm not an expert in any of these topics. You would have to go elsewhere to find that. And for those of you who are experts in those topics, I appreciate your patience with me if I fumble around and don't do as good of a job at this as you could do. And I respect you for that. So thank you for the work that you do as you work in your areas of expertise and have patience for me as I try as best as I can to make sense of this. So one thing that I was thinking about and reading about actually just this very morning is I was reading some of the writings of Edwin Firmage, who is a Jungian analyst and also a Latter-day Saint. I was reading from his chapter in Women in Authority. The chapter is titled Reconciliation. And basically, he's talking about this concept that's very, very Jungian in nature. Carl Jung really does touch into a lot of issues of gender. And he talks a lot about how the healthiest form of humanity acknowledges and embraces that both man and woman has elements of and beauty in their masculinity and in their femininity. And to the extent that we embrace these and fully develop these parts of ourselves, these essences that we each hold both, to the extent that we are able to embrace both our masculinity and our femininity, can we be a healthy self, a healthy marriage, a healthy family, and a healthy culture and a healthy nation? So one of the things that I read this morning, this is again Firmage, he says this: Jung perceived humankind as possessing an impulse towards individuation that can be achieved through seeking within ourselves the image of God. This tendency can compensate for our historical vision of a transactional God beyond reach, an aloof masculine figure in the patriarchal tradition. The immanent God is both maternal and paternal, and is found in our own unconscious. He goes on to say, Christian education has not done enough. Too few people have experienced the divine image as the innermost possession of their own souls, close quote. So let me just spend a second talking to you about what I'm hearing there and why this matters and how it relates to the situation that's going on this week. To the extent that we are able to not only embrace our full masculinity and femininity within ourselves, but also the masculinity and femininity of God, when we're able to actually do this fully, all of the war around gender and hierarchy will diminish. As I've mentioned before on this podcast, what we have done as a patriarchal culture is we have created God in the image of man. Since the beginning of time, or at least predominantly, men have had the power. And so, of course, they create God as a man. This is inclusive of making God a masculine form of a man, not a tender God. And I think that's one of the reasons why if we really look at the life and ministry of Jesus Christ, he is rather radical, because Jesus Christ really carried a lot of femininity. As a matter of fact, I believe Richard Rohr says that Jesus Christ had a masculine form, but a feminine spirit. And what he's actually speaking into is this Jungian idea that full, healthy, whole humanity embraces both the masculinity and femininity. So how do I piece this together in the here and now? Well, what I'm seeing is that because we live in a 21st century American-made capitalist white Christian patriarchal church, I believe that at an unconscious level, the patriarchy in this church is very, very afraid of the feminine. They're probably afraid with the feminine within themselves. They're certainly afraid of embracing a feminine divine. And that translates over into their fear of blending lines of masculinity and femininity inside of queer issues. To believe that masculinity and femininity is in fact on a spectrum is terrifying to someone who is afraid and really keeps at arm's length the feminine. And so what we see here is not only a fear of one's innate internal femininity, which is again God-ordained, but it's a rejection of anyone who isn't rejecting that part of themselves as well. And so that's when we see gender issues, especially queer issues, as terrifying. And then, of course, we create a morality around it and call it sin and say that this is God's will. And what's actually playing out here is one's own rejection of one's own sense of innate divine fullness or wholeness, which is masculinity and femininity. So I'm hoping you're seeing the connection here. When we reject femininity in ourselves, especially when we have the power, we will create a God in our image to justify that God is male, that authority is male, and that anyone who embraces a fullness of femininity and masculinity, inclusive of queer people, all of these things by default are going to be seen as unusual, as frightening, as foreign. And then, of course, in a church setting, we're going to call them sin. So this is the outcome of a masculine power structure that hasn't yet embraced itself as whole, as masculine and feminine. Okay, let's just spend a few moments as we finish this topic up discussing the inevitability that conversation about Heavenly Mother or a feminine divine was going to emerge as women of the church were addressing issues of women and equality. It felt inevitable, and it did, in fact, emerge. And of course it would emerge, because in our faith tradition, we are really struggling with questions about not only gender equality here in this life, but our theology around gender equality in the next life. I want to just go ahead and repeat the quote that I offered a few minutes ago. This once again comes from Edward Brown Firmage from Maxine Hincks's edited book, Women in Authority. The chapter is called Reconciliation, and this gentleman, Firmage, is a Jungian scholar, and he says this. The topic, by the way, is called God Within and Without. That's an important detail to what I'm about ready to talk about. So he says this: Jung perceived humankind as possessing an impulse toward individuation that can be achieved through seeking within ourselves the image of God. This tendency can compensate for our historical vision of a transcendent God beyond reach, an aloof masculine figure in the patriarchal tradition. The immanent God is both maternal and paternal and is found in our unconscious. So, close quote. So what Firmage is getting ready to develop here is that the healthiest way that we can come to define God is to define God as both the essence of masculinity and the essence of femininity, and that that God is both within ourselves and is transcendent. Okay, so let's break this down for just a quick second. So this is what I know seems to emerge in this conversation around theology in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. We struggle with a couple of things that are very, very interconnected and actually quite complicated if you really pause to think about it. Because we are a patriarchal church, we suffer from a loss of a feminine divine. As Carolyn Pearson would say, we live in a motherless house. That's probably one of her more famous poems. And many women throughout history and certainly in the present are longing for a deeper relationship with their Heavenly Mother. What we need to address is this: as we long for and think about the loss of and our desire to reconnect with the feminine divine, sometimes what that conjures up in our minds is an eternal life that is exclusively perhaps heterosexual in nature. So let me just slow that down and reiterate. Our Heavenly Mother theology solves the motherless house problem, but perhaps creates a different problem, creating a heaven and heavenly families as heterosexual, and cisgendered, and thus once again excluding or marginalizing queer people in heaven. There is scholarship out there that really pressures us as Latter-day Saints and Latter-day Saint women to look at the possibility that our deep devotion to Heavenly Mother is perhaps inadvertently a cishet white supremacist issue. What I mean by that is a desire for a Heavenly Mother to some might be unconsciously or unintentionally a perpetuation of a cisgender heterosexual white heaven. And I know this is troublesome, right? Because what we're trying to address here, of course, is a longing for Heavenly Mother. But what also needs to be addressed is the complexity of this longing. It is my feeling that any theology or any God concept and image that creates a system that marginalizes any of their children is something that we need to be hyper aware of and sensitive to. Okay, so how does one manage the complexity of this intersection? The desire for a Heavenly Mother and the desire to be sensitive to the reality that a Heavenly Mother, Heavenly Father, family constellation could possibly be the further perpetuation of a cishet white supremacist heaven. Let me just share with you how I think about it. And I'm not here to say that how I think about it is the right way to think about it. I'm only just sharing with you how I wrestle with this myself in an effort to be generous to and aware of all of the complexities of this issue. First and foremost, I think the very best way to manage situations of this nature is to recognize that we come from a faith tradition that prides itself in knowing God and knowing theology and knowing the nature of the afterlife. I think we are most intellectually and spiritually responsible in moving out of a stance of knowing and in moving ever more close to a stance of unknowing. What this question brings up to me is the importance of intellectual and spiritual humility. The fact of the matter is, we don't know the ultimate things about God. We can know a lot about God's nature or the nature of our creators, but when we start to move into the specifics around the nature of God, especially as it concerns gender and sexuality, it is my feeling that we cannot know. And I think that's important because if we demand that God be masculine and has a feminine counterpart, that does by default complicate the very systems of oppression that we are struggling with here in this life. And I think it's so tempting to reverse engineer heaven to just look like earth. So perhaps what we can instead do is lean on what we know about the nature of God without feeling as if we need to put our finger on exactly who God is and what they look like. Those of you who know me well and who spend time with me in my groups, as we do a lot of depth work around the nature of truth and the nature of healthy whole spirituality, is I'm a big advocate of how we as children of higher powers can create a spirituality that is vibrant for ourselves. And what that actually entails is learning to lean upon our inner divine selves, our true selves, and become truly more capable of recognizing what resonates with us, what tethers us to God, what helps us feel connected, peaceful, and expansive. And that is good theology for us. And to that end, it is my feeling that we can apply these principles to our worship of God. What I mean by that is, while on the one hand, I maintain that we cannot know the nature of God in terms of gender and sexuality. Remember, we solve one problem and cause another one if we feel like we can sort of put our finger on that. And yet at the same time, I believe that as children of God, we have the liberty to create an idea of God that resonates with us as individuals. So do I personally worship and pray to something in my mind that is a construction of a male and a female figure? The answer to that is yes. Not because I know that to be true, not because I necessarily believe in a heterosexual heaven. I don't know what heaven looks like. I feel that the essence of my creators embody a wholeness of masculinity and a wholeness of femininity in a way that I cannot begin to comprehend. I worship that which makes sense to me, not because it's true, but because it resonates with me. And so my invitation to each and every one of us is perhaps to hold lightly what God actually is and what he or she or they look like and how heaven is arranged, but also to feel free to worship him or her as it feels that it bonds us to heaven, because that will help us feel as if we are in deep connection with our own higher powers and our own inner divine. When I feel that I have the ability to define God and then speak to them and imagine them to be for me what resonates with me, then I can come into deep connection with them. And in so doing, what I'm also doing is I'm allowing heaven to be a place of openness and expansiveness. And their nature is all loving and all inclusive of all. So what I'm inviting us each to do is to have an expansive view and also to practice and strengthen our skills of living in mystery, of knowing that we are beloved, and feeling the confidence that we can connect with our higher powers in a way that feels good to us, but also allowing them to be mysterious, allowing them to be something that perhaps we can't quite know, but that we can still worship in a way that feels good to us. Okay, let's move on to another topic. Hello, dear friends. As you probably know, I love creating the Latter-day Struggles podcast for you. I am so committed to providing you with frequent, honest, psychologically sound content to help you find faith, peace, confidence, and direction in your faith journey. However, I need your support. The content and the demands of this podcast have made it necessary for me to give up my previous work as a private practice therapist. As a way for you to show your support and gratitude for my work, I invite you to become a paid subscriber to this podcast, which will give you access to all of the Friday episodes. All Monday episodes will continue to be free of charge because I want you to be able to continue to know what we're exploring each week here on the podcast. So, for only $9.99 a month, you will not only continue to receive the content that has been so pivotal to your faith journey, but you can also help ensure that I can continue to serve this community. Your small cumulative contributions are already making such a difference. And also, you will be honoring the dedication, education, and commitment of a female Latter-day Saint professional who is brave enough to ask to be valued monetarily for her professional contribution to her community. Information on how to subscribe, information on how to become a monthly patron through my Patreon account, and also information on how to make a one-time donation through my professional Venmo account can all be found in my show notes at the bottom of each episode. So thank you so much for your ongoing support and trust. Now, back to the show. If you notice, because we live in a patriarchal culture, it's not unusual for women to borrow traditionally masculine identities. The simple example I'm going to use is to put a woman in a really nice suit coat and pants, slacks, makes all the sense in the world. Nobody thinks twice about that, because what she is doing is she is borrowing from the traditionally one-up gender. Now, mind you, I'm not saying this is a one-up gender. I'm saying this is how culture has defined gender, that maleness is superior and femaleness is inferior. However, because again, in this American culture, at least, or in Western culture at large, you're not generally going to be seeing a traditionally masculine male borrowing down and wearing female clothing. Now, why is this? Once again, because there's something in the subtext of the culture that says one does not borrow down, they only can borrow up. So we can see that we live in a toxic masculine culture just by nature of the fact that even, you know, professed male feminists aren't going to find themselves necessarily wearing a dress to church. They're not going to see that. It is not culturally accepted, because what we need to acknowledge is that women are, and femininity is, at its essence, deep down in the unconscious of our own culture, it is seen as less than. A second example I could give you is, having just done some recent reading on this, this is probably common or familiar to many of you, the historical reality that when women enter into a certain occupation, it almost immediately declines in status and prestige. Once again, I'm just looking at phenomenology and connecting it to our own Latter-day Saint tradition. It came to my mind as I was thinking about this, that it's a possibility, at least, that there's prestige and power and honor that a man holds as he is a priesthood holding person here in the church and elsewhere, where there's a priesthood, a male priesthood, a male only priesthood. But is the same phenomenon at play if and when they share this degree of power with a woman? In the psyche of the man, or the collective of men, does it mean that they worry that the power or honor or significance decreases or diminishes? About half of the Latter-day Struggles listening audience, a little bit less than half, is men. And so I want to be really, really careful to make sure you understand that this is not speaking about men as a collective. It would be just as unfair to treat men as interchangeable as it is to treat women as interchangeable. What I'm just looking at is perhaps at the dominant, patriarchal, traditionally believing Christian male, not even Latter-day Saint male. There's just something going on that's surging through the unconscious that's, you know, it's multi-generational. It's multi-generational. And so this is, if this is not you and this doesn't resonate, it's just more about having some critical awareness that this is what has created a male-dominant culture and a male-dominant church, in our case here with the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So I'm just offering to you my meandering thoughts as I put my ideas together for you to just sort of think about. I'm not saying this is as it is or this is so. I'm just offering to you some things for us collectively to think about as we're making sense of our own tradition and what's going on in this moment in time. If we were to shift gears just a tiny bit and stay with this idea of culture and look at how movements happen, I think that we struggle as a church system with wanting to make sure that we aren't perceived as being persuaded by the world. I really, really notice in the rhetoric of the church that it's very, very important to our own identity as an institution that we stand above and outside of the world. And so what that means by default, of course, is that if we stand above and outside of the world cannot persuade us. We're better than that. We are not going to be persuaded by the world. Now, what we all tend to realize, I think, as we become more spiritually evolved and we're growing and evolving as individuals, is that we cannot but be influenced by the world. We live in the world. We are always being impacted by the world. The world is impacting us and we are impacting the world. And so to say that we're not influenced by the world is, of course, foolish. I think I noticed this rhetoric kind of popping up this week in some of the dialogue that was happening on the Instagram post. And unfortunately, it sort of took a nosedive, you know, from time to time, as is sometimes typical on social media. But I noticed that many of the people that kind of came on, the more traditionally believing Latter-day Saints, came on and accused the more progressive or liberal women that they were being influenced by the world. And of course, what we know about that is that that is something that is incredibly dangerous, according to, you know, the traditional rhetoric, and that we can't look as if we're being influenced by the world. And this sort of circles me back to the first topic that I began us with, which is this idea that even if we're feeling a little bit nervous about the possibility that maybe women don't have equality, sometimes we dig in deeper. And one of the justifications that we use, which is, I can't be persuaded by the world just because the rest of the world is moving more towards equality. As a Christian church, as the true church and the one and only true church, we are not persuaded by the world, rather than actually the most healthy approach. Ironically, I get such a kick out of this. From the psychology perspective, what we know health to be is integration. It's openness. It's curiosity. It's a willingness to learn. It's a willingness to be wrong. It's flexibility. The irony in this is that so much of the foundational rhetoric of Christianity and the Church of Jesus Christ is actually words that express the exact opposite of all of the things I just described, which all define health. Isn't that funny? So think about this. We have been raised, many of us, on really finding a lot of virtue and really trying to self-define as an institution for being firm, unwavering, unmoving, or unmovable, steadfast, unfaltering, unchanging, uncompromising, and unyielding. The irony here is just really interesting to me, because that's not healthy, folks. What we want to strive for, actually, as we evolve and grow, is to become willing to soften and grow, be flexible. And so this is another place where I see why we're struggling so much with this, and why we see ourselves with contending sides, which is one side self-defines using all of these words that, I'm sorry to say, actually are the definition of unhealth. They're the definition of rigidity. They're the definition of closeness, and they're the definition actually of fear. That when we feel to batten down, circle the wagons, become unyielding, unfaltering, unchanging, unwavering, what that means is we're not open to the possibility that there are things that we are doing that maybe we shouldn't be doing, that we aren't looking at ways that we could be learning and growing. We aren't looking at the possibility that other people have something to teach us. And so I think that might also be piece of the puzzle as far as why we struggle so much here in the LDS Church embracing truth and light, because we're so committed to not moving, to not changing, to not being open as revelation pours in through untraditional or unexpected ways. Okay, let's just shift gears a tiny bit and just spend a moment reviewing some of the problematic nature of the Instagram post itself, which is this tendency, again, to create others, to create out-groups and in-groups, to make comparisons, to perpetuate this notion of hierarchy. We, of course, in the church have real struggles with hierarchy and gender. If you think about, to circle back to some of our, you know, fraught and unresolved origin stories with polygamy, women were rewards of men, right? The more righteous men, clear through the end of the era of polygamy, the leadership had polygamous wives, right? Which is, if you wanted to, you know, really advance in the church, you had to have multiple wives. Or I guess it might have been considered you got to have multiple wives, right? And so there's an energy in the church, which is that women are the prize of men, that men are one up, that they have this priesthood power. And sadly enough, this Instagram post actually seemed to probably unwittingly exacerbate more of this same unhealthy hierarchical philosophy. What I heard in this post, and I know there's probably a myriad of good interpretations of this, but what she was saying in this post is that women, you have more authority than women of other churches. Now, what wasn't said, which I thought was interesting, was we're not going to talk about the fact that you have less power than the men in your church, but at least you have more power than the women of other churches. One of the ways that I kind of made sense of this was that there are fewer women that are ordained in other churches, and furthermore, they're playing church and we're not. And therefore, even though they seem to have what looks like more power, you actually have more power, because your power is real power and their power is fake power. And there are fewer of them that have fake power. What you're picking up on, though, hopefully, or what I picked up on at least, was, oh my goodness, we are so committed to creating an adversarial relationship with others in our church, with others in other churches. This, my friends, is just one of the many markers of an early stage faith system, which is we must be tribal. We must be comparing and contrasting who has more of what, who has more revelation, who has more priesthood, who has more access to God, who has more covenants, who has more ordinances, who has more capacity to save others. And the list goes on and on. I'm just kind of trying to diagnose the problem here. By default, we shouldn't have to create any kind of a setup where we are comparing ourselves to anyone else, whether it be women of other faiths or men within our faith. Because if you'll remember, what the gospel of Jesus Christ teaches is that all are alike in God. As children of a higher power, we are all equal in God's eyes. We are all equal. And so anytime a religious institution needs to pit any one party against any other party, that is not of God. And what I found really, really sad as the last several days unfolded was the dialogue that began taking place. I guess dialogue might be generous. It felt in some ways very, very contentious. And what I saw really saddened me because it was tragic to me to see women of the same faith being incredibly belligerent and hostile to one another, which once again, I kind of think about my favorite title of the Givens's books is I love Fiona's title, The God Who Weeps. And I think about that so frequently, probably daily. And I'm looking at this and I'm going, oh dear, God must be weeping right now that all of these people who have good hearts, who are equally beloved by God, in the name of God, in the name of religion, are being so cruel to one another. And in our own way, what we're doing here, of course, is we're creating outgroups of one another. I am right, you are wrong. I am better, you are worse. I'm more evolved, you're less evolved. We are incredibly creative and have any number of ways to make ourselves superior and others inferior. And so I'm frequently challenging myself and challenging the people that I love and whom I serve in my communities that we cannot take the same small-minded judgment and lack of love and just integrate it into a new kind of theology. And I think it's very tempting to do that in cases of this nature. I will be addressing on Friday's episode so much more about the question of women and this idea of power. I did notice as I was just observing a lot of this banter going back and forth on this social media post on the church's Instagram account that some of the more traditionally believing women were accusing the more progressive women of just wanting power. And there's a lot there to that. I found it interesting that by default, what they were actually contending in these moments, actually Nathan pointed this out to me as he was sort of following this too. It's hard to not follow this week, right? But he said, that's interesting that what the post actually was proposing was that women in the church through their temple endowment have an enormous amount of power, more so than any other women outside of the church. And what the women's posts were actually indicating was something far different, which was, we don't have more power and you shouldn't want more power because that's unrighteous, that it isn't God's will that women have power. And so we were sort of just observing and scratching our heads like, oh, isn't this question of power so interesting? Is it that we have power or is it that we don't have power and shouldn't want power? So anyhow, I'm going to go far more into that again in Friday's episode. So stay tuned for that, for a really deep dive into that question. I want to shift gears and just offer to you another independent but very related topic that kind of came up for me, which was this question of shame. And I oftentimes circle around this, and I think it's worth mentioning over and over again because I think it's important. I feel like one of the problems or the struggles that our institution has in being accountable and saying they're sorry or changing their policies is just this question of shame, which is, once again, if I struggle with my own worthiness, and I worry that I'm covering things up and I'm not able to sort of come clean on some of my doctrinal issues or historical issues, if I'm really kind of holding a lot of angst and discomfort about my identity as a human being or as a church, if I struggle with these things and I know that I might benefit in coming clean and I can't, or I don't, or I won't, I have a really hard time confronting anyone who highlights those things. And so because we have a chronic struggle with gender, sexuality, and power here in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, I think there are multiple reasons why this is the case. I think one of them is because we're an American religion, because we live in a patriarchal world, and we are a relatively young religion, and also because our origin story is fraught with issues of gender, sexuality, and power struggle. All of these create a lot of angst and discomfort, I would imagine, in the governing bodies of the church. I understand that. It's a big deal. It's a heavy load to be sort of trying to navigate that and decide, how do we honor what we love and what is part of our identity, and how do we also honor reality? And when someone struggles with shame, there's this fear that, like, the secret might be out if I actually address and acknowledge what is wrong. And so if somebody has a strong ego structure and doesn't struggle with shame, they can say, I'm sorry, because it doesn't impact their identity. It doesn't impact who they are. We can always trace the breadcrumbs back from lack of accountability, and always we will find shame. And so I want to just hold that out to each of you as you notice the struggles that we perpetually seem to have with accountability. And that is because I believe there is some sense of not enoughness, of unlivability, of unlovability, and of this potential that maybe if we come clean and we say we've made some mistakes in history, we've made some mistakes in policy, in our theology, we've made some mistakes in the handling of money, we've made some mistakes in the really distressing issues of reporting sexual child abuse. We've made some mistakes. If we make mistakes, we do need to deal with them. We would garner the respect of people who recognize our growth as an institution, who recognize that we're willing to be accountable. And when we recognize that we're in a relationship of actual good faith, I love that phrase. If we're in a good faith relationship, it means all parties are trying to be accountable. And it would be my hope that faith systems would also be in good faith with themselves and with their own constituents and with the larger world. So to go just a little bit deeper into this concept of shame, by the way, all of us struggle with shame. I think this is more a matter of degree than kind. And I think a lot of good psychological work is actually about the coming into a relationship with these parts of ourselves where we feel not enough. I don't know why, but I've noticed as a clinician working for thousands of hours with people in therapy and otherwise, all of us have this existential fear that we're not enough, that we're bad, we're not lovable. And that's in one way, actually, I had an aha moment not too long ago where it occurred to me that no wonder we suffer in systems of faith where not only do we bring that with us as just human beings, but then if the system of faith in any way perpetuates or heightens or uses that against us, this sense that I am not enough, it can be toxic to the development of the soul of the human being, because what we need from our religious systems and from our relationships and from our families is we need to be fed a consistent dose of the opposite, which is, even though you worry that you're not enough, you are enough, you are good, you are worthy. And so we want our systems of faith and our theology and our understanding of our higher powers to perpetuate a healing of that very existential fear. And so what we notice when someone has a lot of shame is that they have these counterparts of their identities where, instead of acknowledging the shame, because that'd be too scary, that'd be confirming, you know, the biggest fear of all, what they do instead is they create these defenses and they create these protector parts. And I want to invite you to go to episode number 63 of Latter-day Struggles. It's called Christ-Centered Activism Part 2, A Psychological Look at Combative Discourse. And in that episode, I actually kind of map out my thought process on the defense strategies that are oftentimes used here in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints to sort of manage what I see as some struggles with shame. And so again, when we have a core of shame or when we struggle with these unresolved wounds, we create accompanying defenses or protective stances to not confront our shame. And so what I think I saw here this week was sort of more of the same of some of these sort of traditional stances that the church, and I guess, you know, I know there are some of you out here that kind of don't like it when I just say the church. That feels kind of nebulous. So you'll have to forgive me because I keep doing it. But what I guess I mean is, whether it be what we hear through curriculum, through official statements, through the social media at church, the majority narrative of the church probably would be the clearer way to say this. But I notice that in issues of gender equality in our institution, I just saw, again, more of the same here, both speaking of the commentary going back and forth between the contending, you know, groups, the more traditionally believing women and men, and the responding from the people that are more progressive wanting to address these issues of authority. But what many of us on the side of progress and on the side of reform experience or see are these tactics that I think represent a protective part or the defenses that the church uses, because they do feel perhaps painted into a corner. One true church, inspired by God, which by default means we don't get things wrong, which also makes things very complicated because there's clear and present evidence that we have gotten things wrong. And so what happens is these defensive strategies sort of grow and grow and grow. So what I see is some degree of denial that there is a problem. What a lot of women mentioned was the word gaslighting, which is this case of warping one's own reality, telling someone that they're not having the experience that they're having. That's really psychologically damaging, to tell someone they don't feel or they shouldn't feel the way they're feeling. I guess it's really more that there's a difference between being told you shouldn't feel a certain way and being told that your reality isn't actually real. And I think that's what many women experienced on this particular incident, is that I don't know why you're saying you don't have power. You do have power, and this is how we can interpret your power. Women felt gaslit. Some of the other defensive strategies that I've noticed are kind of typically used, but were used in both directions, quite honestly, is name calling. Lots of people called women angry feminists and made a lot of derogatory comments about what it means to want equal rights as women. There were some accusations that women who are wanting to have a conversation and are asking for equality, they were being accused of having a lack of faith. There were scriptures quoted against them, or us, I should say, fulfillment of prophecy. This is the sifting of the wheat and the tares. I also find it interesting that sometimes women themselves are used to promote the patriarchy. And of course, this is oftentimes the case with women who are promoted to general leadership positions, is oftentimes they maybe unwittingly or maybe not, but they end up actually being the spokespeople inviting or demanding that women of this institution perpetuate their inequality. And I think this is tragic, quite frankly, but I also think it's tricky, because what a patriarchal institution wants and needs is they want to perpetuate themselves and their own structures of power. And so they will only promote the women that are the guardians of the patriarchy. I think that's something to think about, and something that we have to just be aware of, while also realizing that most reform doesn't come from the top down, right? It comes from the bottom up. It comes from a critical mass of people doing exactly what we are doing here, which is saying, this is no longer acceptable. It hasn't been for a long time, but we haven't really had a forum in which we could come together and say this as a body. And so I think this is important. We do so not from a position of a high structural power in the church, but we have a great deal of power in our numbers. So I just kind of mentioned and sort of focused on some of the tactics and strategies that our more traditionally believing have in sort of diminishing and minimizing the reality of issues of gender inequality here in the LDS church. And I kind of want to circle back to a little bit of what happened again on this post as it unfolded, and there were, you know, hundreds and then thousands and thousands of responses. Something that I picked up on is that, first of all, as this rhetoric picks up, things deteriorate on both sides. And I understand this. I can tell just by having witnessed and watched this that the women who still care and who desperately want gender equality, there is an enormous well of hurt, of a feeling unlistened to, legitimately unlistened to, unheard. So much so that when there was that moment in time that I guess there was a meta glitch and something happened on social media and all the comments looked like they kind of went away. There was a really strong response throughout hundreds and hundreds of comments in this very short period of time of women who felt this new devastating wave of betrayal that the church itself would delete all of their comments. And again, just sort of watching this, but also witnessing and also being, I was kind of in this weird spot because I am a woman and I'm experiencing this firsthand and I had all the feelings, right? And then also I try as hard as I can to take a step back and observe and watch this phenomenon unfolding. And what I observed was the collective trauma of so many women in the LDS faith who had such low confidence, quite honestly, that the church will listen to them. And of course, this makes sense. And it makes me sad to acknowledge this, but I feel that it's true. And so I'm going to just be candid here. The women haven't been listened to for many, many, many years. And I think the cries are getting more pronounced because as the years go by, the rest of the Western world is taking better care of their women than our churches. There are many of us who have children or grandchildren who will never live in a world of inequality except for on a Sunday morning. And that wasn't necessarily the case even just a few decades ago or a generation or two ago. There was a lot more sameness in the inequality that women experienced, I'm sad to say, but now that is not so much the case. And so the women are understandably hurt. And sometimes when we are hurt, we become hostile. I get that. And so I really hold the tension of not bypassing the pain because it's very, very real. And also there's another side of me that is looking at the importance of this moment and looking at how key it is that each of us do our very best to step into our higher selves and not be a part of the escalation of a problem, but actually become part of the solution. I'm consistently working with the people over whom I have any influence directly or indirectly. I'm consistently inviting people to step into their true selves. I'm wanting us to step into who we are, and we know, at least in theory, that the only way that change can happen and that we can be persuaded or be persuasive is through love. And so I know it's a timing thing. I know that it's hard, and I know that growth requires a great deal of the metabolization of pain. And I get that. And so I'm very careful to sort of titrate what I talk about. Sometimes just being in the pain is all we can do. And I've been there myself. I get that. And also, I am a believer that we can step into our higher power and embody love. And as a matter of fact, I believe strongly that if we are on a faith journey and we have moved out of the stage of faith, which is the orthodoxy, and we are moving into something further in and further up, as C.S. Lewis says, that we need to begin to truly practice the embodiment of more and more love, which means We stand our ground and we ask for equality of gender, but we do so from a place of compassion, curiosity, clarity, creativity, calm, confidence, courage, and connectedness. Now, I did not come up with those 8 C's, by the way. Those are the characteristics of the true self. And so as we step into our power as true selves, we are truly actually having, we're showing through our embodied expressions, through our conversations, through the way we live our lives, that we are embodying true deepening spirituality. If we say we're growing spiritually and we have kind of awakened to some of the problems of the church, but we act in hostile ways, I don't think that's actually embodying a lot of growth, quite honestly. And to add to that, sometimes when we respond in anger, our more traditionally believing family, friends, and leaders will actually use that anger as a way to deflect away from the main issue. And they will use our bad behavior to justify their bad behavior and to reinforce all of the majority narrative about what it means to be where we are on our journey. So the last thing we want to do is weaken our cause and act smaller than we truly are as we are growing. I know that this is hard, and so I'm not encouraging people to not be experiencing what they're experiencing, but I'm also pressuring each of us to step into our power as we try to grow closer to what it means to be truly embodied by love. I think we will always, if we choose to be inside of a collective, which is any sort of a community, we are always going to notice that we as individuals are going to grow faster than the body itself or than the institution. Human beings have a remarkable capacity to grow. We are wired to grow. We want to grow. It's almost hard to prevent us from growing because life itself sets itself up to be a space of growth. Suffering, which is sort of part of what it means to be human, activates growth. Love activates growth. And so as human beings, we are inclined to grow in ways that institutions are not, because institutions actually are really more interested in perpetuating themselves. They're interested in staying viable. Generally speaking, when you have something in its beginning phase, there's something that's really mystical and profound about the beginning of a movement. And within one generation, those trying to perpetuate this movement become more interested in the perpetuation of the organization and of their maintaining their own power. And oftentimes the vision and the magic and the beauty and the mystery and the profound nature of truth that came about in the founding of the institution, and this can be church or otherwise, that oftentimes diminishes because the institution itself becomes interested in perpetuating itself. I am not speaking of our church, by the way. This is a phenomenology that is true of any great movement. We have to be super careful as we observe that by the second generation, this is almost an inevitability, unless people have a really high level of consciousness that this is a possibility. So what this means is that we as human beings on the ground, in the pews, at church, our lives are giving us huge opportunities to grow. And so oftentimes we are in fact going to grow faster than our institution. So what does that mean? That means that we are the only means collectively, as we gain that critical mass, we are the only means by which we can invite and invoke institutional change. And most of the time, it is my belief that we do so most effectively when we step into our power and we use the growth that has awakened us and implement and embody more and more love so that we can encourage those around us to grow as well. Now, I know that some people have decided that this is a painful place to be, and for that reason, they don't feel like this is where they want to do their growth work. And I personally think that's perfectly fine. I think that it's so important for us to recognize that we are here on this life to have a journey, and that this journey can happen in so many places. And it's not about the one true place to have one's life journey. What I think is fascinating is that if the church would allow us to experience gender equality and experience growth on our own terms and let church be a place of inquiry and openness and community, that we would stay more committed to the church because we felt a bond of affinity, not because we felt like we needed to be here to have our salvation. That's kind of the irony. And I think this is where the church needs to be very, very aware of what they're doing right now, is because if women feel that they are being stifled in their growth here in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, there will be a few of us who want to engage in the wrestle of reform, but there will be a lot of women who decide that this is too stifling to their growth, and therefore they will leave. And this is heartbreaking to me, because this is this cohort of women that have awakened to their potential, to who they are, to their value, to their goodness, their worthiness. They are some of the women that could really strengthen this church, as are their children. So I think this is something for us to really think about as we wrestle with these issues of gender and power. Okay, I feel like it's time to close. I have said plenty. I hope as I've strung my thoughts together, this has made some sense to you. I think I want to close with a thought that I want to give Carolyn Pearson credit for. I don't think this is a direct quote, but I read this not too long ago, and it really touched me. And I think this is an important way for us to think about this issue that we're experiencing in this day and age right now. The enemy is not men. The enemy is not the church. The enemy is a lack of consciousness. And this can only be addressed with love, which is a heightening of consciousness. Anger, rage, and hate only serve to lower our collective levels of consciousness. I think it's tempting for us to create an enemy. But what I want us to think about as we consider this issue is that consciousness, unawareness, is the thing that we're trying to overcome. I am a feminist. I believe that women are equal, not better than men. I believe that God created all of their children as equal. And it's the lack of consciousness that is causing our church to suffer. I've given a whole list of reasons in the last hour and a half or so of reasons why I see this happening. But at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is raise the consciousness of people that don't understand the nature of the problem. There is a low level of consciousness about what it means to truly see as God sees and to allow all of God's children to flourish in this life and in the institutions where they choose to grow. That is the lack of consciousness that we're trying to help our brothers and sisters in this church overcome. Albert Einstein says, no problem can be solved from the same level of consciousness that created it. And we know that the level of consciousness that created patriarchy it comes from a place of fear, anxiety, a need to control, and a desire to have power. That's all rooted in fear. Thousands and thousands of years ago, people were afraid, as they are now. And so what did they do? They created outgroups. They created power structures. We're still fighting this power structure problem in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And so what must we do is we try to change our own level of consciousness so that as the level of consciousness evolves away from hate and fear and moves toward love, we reach a higher level of consciousness in this institution. And as our level of consciousness changes, that is the only way that this problem can be solved. It cannot be solved by counterattacking. It cannot be solved by character attacking. It can only be solved by embodying love. And that is the love that I believe Jesus Christ exemplified in his life. And we are all here purporting to want to follow the mission and example of Jesus Christ. And that is the only way I see this changing, is the level of consciousness needs to change. Richard Rohr says, every viewpoint is a view from a point. And our vantage point is changed utterly by God. So as we ourselves awaken, try to better understand, get a lay of the land, conceptualize what's going on, better understand why it is that this institution struggles so much with this, we can become more empowered. We can make sense of the nature of our own struggles, of the struggles of the institution. We as women and men who understand, who are in this higher level of consciousness, we can use that consciousness to be persuasive in powerful ways and then choose how to forge our paths. And when we act in love, we are activating and embodying the identity of God's children that I think we're all here to embody. So is this a tough topic? Absolutely. Is it discouraging? Yes. Is our faith journey evoking incredible transformation and change in many of us? Yes. Can we use this time, this experience, to practice being more and more like who we are here to become? Yes. My hope is today, as I close up, maybe you have a few things to think about around the questions of gender equality, sexuality, and power here in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. You may not even agree with everything I say, and that's okay, because what I'm here to do is actually invite you to think and feel and discern and discover for yourself what feels like goodness, truth, and light. And if there are things that you don't agree with, that's great. I love, oftentimes I'll have people say, I love your podcast. I don't agree with everything, but I really love it. And in my mind, I'm like, well, good. I don't expect you, nor do I need you to agree with everything. Because remember, relationship is not about everyone believing the same way. It's about everyone accepting and loving one another as we go on this journey together. And I, for one, am very, very grateful that you are allowing me a little part of your reality. I'm glad that I'm on this journey with you. I thank you for being a part of this Latter-day Struggles community. Join me next time on Friday for a second part. On Friday, I'm going to be actually exploring and doing an analysis of one of the chapters in Maxine Hanks's Women in Authority. I'm going to be doing an analysis of the chapter titled An Expanded Definition of Priesthood, Some Present and Future Consequences. This is by, the author is Meg Wheatley. And what this is going to be discussing basically is that I'm going to be looking at organizational behavior and how the dynamics of an organization say more about the value of their constituents than the words that the organization says about their constituents. And so I'm going to be really going deeply into that, because that has been one of the prominent things that women have felt and are continuing to feel here in the LDS Church, which is you say certain things, but it's clear in the structure of the church that what you say is not what is meant, and certainly it is not what is felt. So deep dive into that next time. And in the meantime, if this has been something that has been valuable to you, please share this far and wide. I really appreciate those of you who support me here on the Latter-day Struggles platform. Please subscribe to the Friday episodes to help me be able to provide this ongoing content. I can only do this content as I'm doing if I have your support. And those subscriptions really go a long way in helping me see that I can continue to offer you the time and energy and heart that I offer you here on this platform. Also, go jump over to latterdaystruggles.com if you want to look into any of my upcoming groups. If you want to join one of my Latter-day Night Live groups, it's a one Wednesday a month gathering where I offer to you some live content, and you get a digital workbook and you get the video recording, plus you participate in a question answer session. Each month it's a different topic. So jump onto latterdaystruggles.com and see what topic I am covering this coming month. Also, check into seeing if you'd like to do any individual work with me as a limited time offering, or if you want to work with one of my team. So jump over to latterdaystruggles.com for all of that information. Thank you all. Bye-bye.
Dialogue Podcast Network.